Hello and welcome. My name is Nicholas Morgan, and I'm a freelance journalist working with Of All News. Today, I'm speaking to Dr. Michael Rubin, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., where he specializes in Turkey and the broader Middle East. He also served as an advisor in the Pentagon during the Bush administration. Dr. Rubin, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, the U.S.-Turkey lobby for a time attracted a lot of attention, particularly after the whole Michael Flynn affair, when he plotted to kidnap Fethullah Gulen, a cleric who is opposed to President Erdogan in Turkey and who is accused of being behind the July 2016 coup attempt against him. Beyond Flynn, there are others, for instance, like Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer and former mayor of my hometown, New York City, who has spoken up for Erdogan's interests. Giuliani worked for a firm that lobbied for Erdogan, and he advocated for defunding Gulen-linked schools in the U.S. He also reportedly pushed President Trump to intervene in the Halk Bank case going through the Southern District of New York courtroom. These both came after meetings Giuliani had with Erdogan in Ankara in 2018. We also know by now that Turkish lobbyists have spent pretty significant sums on properties connected to the president's company in Washington. So my question to you is, do you think these investments and connections do enough to explain the Trump administration's unwillingness to hold Turkey accountable when its interests conflict with U.S. ones?
Well, honestly, we're only going to know in hindsight what the true story is. It's also been a bit of a haphazard and sloppy approach. Look, the various Turkish groups spent a great deal of money on Michael Flynn, but it was the fact that Michael Flynn had switched positions so rapidly and had spoken in such granular detail about an issue which anyone who had talked to him knew he hadn't known much, which raised the sort of red flags which ultimately created some legal problems for him. I mean, the fact of the matter is Turkey is trying, but it's unclear whether Donald Trump is sympathetic to Erdogan simply because he struck up a good relationship with him, or whether there's something more nefarious going on. But without doubt, Turkey's trying.
Okay, so that leads into my next question, which ties into the ongoing election right now. On July 21st, you wrote an op-ed in the Washington Examiner that details some of the connections between Turkey-connected individuals and the Joe Biden campaign. Elvir Klempich of the Turkish Heritage Organization holds a position now with the campaign. Murat Güzel, who you pointed out previously attempted outreach to the Clinton campaign in 2016, has donated the maximum to Biden and other Democrats during the primary season. In the aftermath of Biden's remarks that were critical of Erdogan, Güzel tried watering their seriousness down, insisting, quote, "Joe didn't mean this," unquote. Can you tell us why you consider these individuals to be potential risk factors? Do you think that they could lead to any potential influence on a Biden foreign policy despite his own stated stance on Erdogan and Erdogan's Turkey?
Well, look, on one hand, some sympathizers with either of those individuals or organizations can say, this is just coincidence. We're donating money to our preferred candidate based on our preferred positions as an American, and that's all well and good. The reason for suspicion, however, is twofold. There is a WikiLeaks dump several years ago of leaked emails from Berat Albayrak, currently the finance minister in Turkey, yes, and President Erdogan's son-in-law, in which a plan was exposed in the course of those emails to start up various organizations in order to unofficially lobby and skirt American laws. You could argue perhaps the Turkish Heritage Organization, the SITA Foundation, or other groups may have been involved in this, according to those emails between various Turkish activists and President Erdogan's son-in-law. If that's the case, it raises suspicion about whether these are just standalone donations or something else. Certainly, anyone is allowed to donate money. And unfortunately, in American politics, money often talks. It's unseemly, but there's an element to pay to play. Now, when it comes to this notion about whether Elver Klempich is moving from the Turkish Heritage Organization into the Biden camp and what this could mean, first of all, make no mistake, the Biden now claims over 2,000 different foreign policy advisors. In reality, not much has been established yet. You've got three or four top people, but this election in the United States isn't so much about foreign policy, it's about other issues. That said, if Joe Biden is elected, or if Donald Trump is reelected, it's common for people who have donated money or have participated in some way in the campaign to then say, okay, because I contributed here, you need to provide me a job. Any incoming president will have a team which is going to vet political appointees. And one of the things the vetters will ask is, can you show us any evidence that you helped our candidate, that you worked for our candidate? And that's where maximizing donations comes into play. Someone who's just Joe Schmo on the street who hasn't donated anything to a political campaign isn't going to be able to request a meeting with the president or his top advisors. Someone who has maxed out their donations certainly will. And so this is why it's curious that we have people that aren't simply donating to the Biden campaign, but have a history of donating to both campaigns in order to ensure that they have access no matter what.
You know, you brought up a really good point on how, on the expansiveness of the Biden campaign's foreign policy team. It was reported in Politico several months ago now that some of the hands belong to various foreign embassies in across the U.S. They found it difficult to enter into any sort of contact with the Biden campaign because of residual worries from 2016 when the Russians were interacting with many members of the incoming Trump administration. And it seems to me that the Turks have two figures now who are connected to really important Turkish American groups directly on the inside of the Biden campaign. Would you say that that's particularly concerning, that these two in particular have managed to get official positions basically with potentially the next US president?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's count our blessings that in the United States, one person alone isn't going to be able to make policy. I mean, oftentimes people think it's the State Department makes policy or the president, but in reality, it's Congress. And so everything is subject to debate. That said, we'd be kidding ourselves if certain positions didn't matter and didn't influence that policy debate. But we know from the 2016 campaign that Turkey's consistent efforts to make an end run around U.S. law and around U.S. legal processes occurs. That in 2016, people within Turkey, experts within the Clinton campaign, raised internal alarms, and we know this because of the leaked emails of campaign chief of staff John Podesta. The same thing arguably is happening here, and that's what I was raising alarm bells with. Again, Biden may count several thousand foreign policy advisors, but it's only the guys at the top, three or four people right now, who really on a day-to-day basis have any sway on Biden's foreign policy positions. I've talked to some of them, and it's just certainly one of these issues which they're now on the lookout for, because they recognize that malign forces are going to try to act in an opaque manner rather than simply win the battle of ideas. They're going to try to buy the battle of ideas.
Okay. You actually touched on one part of the next question already, but the Turkish Heritage Organization is not the only one of these Turkish American or Turkey financed organizations that are operating in the U.S. right now that have come up for scrutiny in the past. several of these organizations, like the THO, of course, Dianet Center of America, the Turkish American Steering Committee, we know now that several have had members interviewed by the FBI over their activities. In one case, we even saw what looked like direct coordination between the head of THO and Erdogan's son-in-law, as you mentioned, through the leaked WikiLeaks email. What exactly are these groups doing that is different than other lobbies in the U.S. that is so concerning that they invite this extra scrutiny?
Well, there's two things going on. First of all, make no mistake, Turkey has always lobbied through organizations, even well before the Erdogan years. You had groups like the American Turkish Council and so forth, which lobbied actively for active American-Turkish partnership. The difference is that these groups in the past did what they did openly and transparently. They weren't trying to hide anything. They weren't trying to pretend to be something they were not. What's going on now is twofold. Questions about whether these groups are being straight shooters, and certainly, I mean, to be fair, the Turkish Heritage Organization, even though it's had its problems in the past, their leadership will deny that they have any of this relationship that many people believe them to have. I just want to put that out there. But what's going on also is just ever since the 2016 election, allegations of Russian involvement, the Justice Department has been cracking down across the board on violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And of course, what FARA is, what F-A-R-A, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, is this notion that, look, it's permissible to have foreign money enter a debate, but it's got to be declared. You can't act on behalf of a foreign government or foreign political party without filing declarations about that. And a number of officials have gotten into trouble, whether it's for allegedly taking money or skirting the laws with regard to Turkey, with regard to Russia, with regard to China, with regard to Qatar or the United Arab Emirates. And so on one hand, you have Erdogan himself losing the public policy debate and trying to make an end run around it. And at the same time, it's coming against a backdrop of a much broader decision within the U.S. Justice Department that has nothing to do with Turkey to crack down on people abusing or not abiding by this law. That's what's going on. And that's why the FBI has been, according to these emails, investigating some of these organizations, which again, the WikiLeaks emails show were set up for an express purpose of unofficially representing President Erdogan's policy perspectives.
So focusing on FARA for a second, but you mentioned that after 2016 and worries about Russian interference in that election, that the Justice Department has moved to more strictly enforce that law. But before that, FARA was still considered more of an underused tool. It's a very old law that goes back to the 1930s when the U.S. government was trying to clamp down on Nazi propaganda in the United States. And it still seems that the number of cases, while significant in recent years, has gone up. It still isn't exactly, it's not overly enforced either still. And this leads to my next question, which is if these kind of ties to Ankara are already revealed, why is it that they continue to evade these registration requirements in the case of, say, THO or the Turkish American Steering Committee?
Well, I mean, honestly, you would have to ask them that. There have been some groups which have long evaded FARA registration, which in recent years have either retroactively or begun to register as foreign agents on behalf of the government of Turkey. In Turkey's longtime law firm, Salzman, I forget the second name in the law firm.
Lavinch?
Yeah, exactly, recently registered, I believe. And so it, on one hand, perhaps it's a matter of time. On the other hand, there's always been a certain disdain in among Erdogan and his advisors for these legal processes, whether they're in the United States, whether they're in Europe, whether they're in Turkey. And so the direction from above may be, you know, just we're not going to be transparent about this. We don't want to be transparent about this. And we're going to resist as long as we are able. And if it means a few people are sacrificed to the U.S. Justice Department, so be it. But at this point, Erdogan may believe that he can get away with it. And I mean, honestly, I don't think he's correct in that. Although I should say that Erdogan, to his credit, has shown a remarkable ability to sort of be the president whisperer when it comes to the White House. He had decent relations with George W. Bush. He had fantastic relations, at least until 2013, with Barack Obama. Barack Obama, of course, famously talked about Erdogan as one of his most trusted foreign friends, joked about how he went to Erdogan for advice about raising daughters. And of course, Trump has a very close relationship with Erdogan. Erdogan may believe that if somehow he can bypass all the advisors who have come to be critical of Turkey and get directly into the Oval Office, then he can succeed. And therefore, why should he bother abiding by all this regulatory, what in his view would be crap?
Okay, so moving back to DC, you wrote a piece in the Washington Examiner on August 9th about how the State Department has a quote unquote Turkey problem. You pointed out examples where state ignored the abusive behavior of Turkish proxies in northern Syria, where U.S. troops work with the local Kurdish forces, Turkey's policy in the East Mediterranean, and undermining Iran's sanctions as examples. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton even once said that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo described the current U.S. Special Representative to Syria, James Jeffrey, as anti-Kurdish and pro-Turkish. Where does this soft spot for Turkey come from within the State Department? Is this something recent that has taken shape within U.S. foreign policy?
Well, first of all, I'm an analyst and I don't just work, as you said in the introduction, on Turkey, but I'm frequently going to some of the other regional countries. And I've actually been asked by heads of state and by ministers among some of Turkey's neighbors and also other regional states who have referred to Special Envoy Jeffrey or other diplomats coming by and saying that they lack all credibility, that they seem more Turkish than the actual Turkish diplomats. And so what's the reason for this? Generally, there's two. Some people have gone to Turkey as diplomats, and Turkish is a very hard language to master. Turkey is a very pleasant country to be in. And so they will have successive tours in perhaps not only Ankara, but Istanbul, Izmir, and so forth, maybe Adana. And they fall in love with the country and they accept its narrative uncritically. If they're only being exposed to one side of the narrative, they may truly believe what they're being told by Recep Tayyip Erdogan and their Turkish interlocutors. Others will privately acknowledge that that Erdogan has been a malign influence on Turkish-American relations, but they will hold out hope that Turkey is so important, that Turkey is so big, that Turkey is such an important ally, that they simply don't want to have the United States conduct any actions which are going to permanently undercut that alliance. They hope that things will snap back once Recep Tayyip Erdogan is no longer president, once he dies or passes on from the scene. Still others who've gone to Turkey while they were single and so forth, perhaps they worked for the defense attaché office or something. If they went when they were single, it's possible that Turkey has information on them. Turkey is a robust surveillance state. Or perhaps they've married Turks and have a, who reinforce a narrative which they may believe is pro-Turkish, but is really much more narrow, just pro-AKP, pro-Erdogan. And that also, I mean, separately, you didn't ask it, but it brings us to the Turkish embassy. Once upon a time, the Turkish embassy really represented Turkey as a democracy. And today, everyone just looks at the Turkish embassy as the office of the AKP, to the extent that most of the other political parties have appointed their own political representatives to Washington, because otherwise they realize that they will no longer get heard. As the AKP tries to monopolize discussion, it can sort of artificially reinforce this notion. And again, it's not just a Turkey thing. We've had this sort of semblance of, first of all, within lobbies within the State Department, there's a remarkable parallel to what goes on with people who have served in Pakistan over the years and have really internalized the Pakistani narrative. But when it comes to this notion that perhaps Jim Jeffrey is just a realist, that he just believes that Turkey is too big to fail, you can go back to Frank Ricciardone, who's now the president of the American University in Cairo, used to be the ambassador to Egypt, who famously said in 2005, before the Arab Spring, that Hosni Mubarak was so impressive that if he ran for election in the United States, he could win election here. It's that sort of State Department tendency towards sycophancy, which diplomats may believe is sophisticated and which will open doors and allow work to occur, but in the long term can be really corrosive to civil society and to bilateral relations.
So to me, it sounds like this issue that the State Department has is very institutional in a sense. And that leads me into a follow-up question. Is this same kind of bias that can be exhibited by officials working abroad in places like Turkey in this case, is that present in other branches of the U.S. foreign policy apparatus related to Turkey or others, like, say, the Pentagon or the intelligence community?
Well, not to the same extent anymore. And this, again, is nothing new within the State Department. Currently, American diplomats, American Foreign Service officers will serve usually 2 to 3 years in a post. And the reason why they will serve only 2 to 3 years in a post before moving on is because this goes back to Henry Kissinger during the Nixon administration, who basically complained that too many American diplomats were becoming infected by what he called localitis or clientitis, where they became too sympathetic to the country in which they were serving rather than to the United States, and therefore mandated at the expense of expertise that people rotate around much more frequently than they do. That notion has been undercut a little bit just by the sheer difficulty of the Turkish language. That when people have mastered it, it becomes a factor in bidding for new posts. And even though they might not serve consecutive tours in Turkey, you can go, for example, from Turkey to Beirut and then back to Turkey, and it leads to a net result where you have this Turkish lobby develop. Robert Kaplan had written about this in his book, The Arabist, not in the context of Turkey, but in the context of the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs within the State Department. But within the CIA, within the Pentagon, within the Pentagon, these guys, there's a different relationship that exists between diplomats who might interact over cocktail parties and military guys who might conduct exercises in the field. They're in trenches together, they're spending days together in adverse conditions and so forth. It becomes much more of a bonding experience. And when I've talked to both Americans who have served in Turkey, as well as Turkish officers, remember, I continue to work for the US Navy teaching on ships. And when Turkish officers come on board, I have the opportunity to talk to them outside the mechanism of the surveillance state. And everyone will refer to how many Turkish generals, how many Turkish flag officers have been arrested. These are friends. These are colleagues of American officers. That's fundamentally changed the attitude of the Pentagon. And when it comes to the intelligence community, they're not as interested in what Turkey says. They're interested in what Turkey does. And when the evidence becomes overwhelming that Turkey is supporting, supplying, groups which the United States considers to be terrorist groups, there comes a point where it simply can't be denied anymore. I would say the reason why the State Department has lagged behind the rest of the U.S. government is simply because wishful thinking tends to come into play more in the State Department, that diplomats want to gear policy towards what they wish Turkey would be rather than what they will recognize Turkey has become.
So how does that bias on the part of the State Department play then into perhaps the the agenda set by the White House. President Obama had made it a point to want to work with Turkey up until later in the war in Syria, when his relationship with Erdogan completely soured, and he upheld Turkey as a model of what he believed Islam and democracy could be in the region. And then, of course, we know that President Trump has a relationship that he loves to brag about with President Erdogan, and that members of his administration have complained about how quickly he will acquiesce to Erdogan's demands. Where do you see the interplay between maybe the position of the White House and this institutional bias that might be within the State Department in setting this Turkey policy?
Well, I mean, in the case of the White House, I'm not going to blame the State Department for that, simply because Donald Trump tends to act on whatever Donald Trump wants to act on. It's just the nature of the president. And Trump's aides worry that, I mean, Trump will be most influenced by whoever he spoke to last. Frankly, Joe Biden's advisors say the same thing about the former vice president, that he will be unduly influenced by whoever he spoke with last. And so perhaps Erdogan, this again is why Erdogan hopes, if he can only get a foot in the door, he can bypass the growing concerns which are beginning to infect the State Department as well, despite the presence of figures like Jim Jeffries or Rich Outson and so forth. I mean, the State Department may have been slow to wake up to reality, but it is starting to wake up. But beyond that, you have the whole issue, and we haven't talked about it, about Congress. When Namık Tan was ambassador to Washington 10 years ago, he used to brag about how the American-Turkish caucus, the Turkish-American caucus in Congress, had more than 250 members, and that this was a metric, this was a sign of just how close the U.S.-Turkish relationship had become. Well, if you're going to believe Namık Tan, now that the Turkish-American caucus has only about half that number, and I've gone around to some of these figures, and most of them don't even realize that they are still in the Turkish-American caucus, it raises questions just about how deeply Turkey's cachet has fallen inside Congress. And again, this is something which Recep Tayyip Erdogan doesn't realize. He's used to envisioning his own presidency as a very strong presidency. The American presidency is traditionally a very weak presidency. And if you lose Congress, you lose Congress. The State Department can throw up some flack, they can run some interference, but ultimately it's Congress that's going to decide. We most recently saw this with the lifting of the arms embargo on Cyprus. Of course, Congress had ordered this last December. The State Department had thrown in some flack with regard to money laundering and Russian port calls, but ultimately Pompeo was able to work that through and the arms embargo was lifted on Cyprus. The fact of the matter is Erdogan has never accurately gauged US policy. And when he relies on people like Cüneyt Zapsu, for example, who used to be in the United States and will just tell Erdogan what he wants, or when he relies on Ibrahim Kalin and so forth, he's simply not going to get an appreciation of the nuance of what US policy has become. More broadly, I mean, without doubt, and I've been told this directly by Turkish diplomats, that the Turkish embassy has a blacklist. Anyone who's not 100% pro-Erdogan is no longer invited. What this means, and big deal, I mean, I have two young kids, I don't go to embassy functions anyway, but what this means is that even the embassy isn't able to accurately report what's going on in Washington because they're only allowed to talk to people that agree with them. And ultimately that is causing a much greater decline in Turkish's prestige than has ever existed before.
It's interesting that you mentioned this blacklist that is maintained by the Turkish embassy, because one of the common accusations, of course, that is levied by the AKP and Erdogan against their critics is that they are supporters of Fethullah Gulen, and they have targeted his associates and educational foundations here in the United States, And I want to turn just a little bit towards that topic for a second. You once strongly objected to the Gulenist movement, but your opinion has changed somewhat on that. And I want to ask, can you tell us what you think now about the movement, and what do you think about their involvement with both the July 2016 coup attempt and their presence in the U.S. today?
Okay, well, let's just go straight through this. When it comes to visa violations, which are the main basis objections to the schools, if they have engaged in visa violations, then they should pay the price of the law. If they have used the schools for any mission other than education, if they, again, have violated U.S. visa policy and so forth, then people should go to jail. No ifs, ands, or buts. I mean, what's ironic is I used to be criticized by people in the Erdogan government for being too critical of Gulen. And the reason was I'm generally critical of political Islamists that would subvert democracy. You talked about how Obama had talked about Turkey. The term he used was actually model partnership because it was an Islamic democracy. Colin Powell, during the Bush administration in which I worked, also referred to Turkey as an Islamic democracy. The way I tend to look at it is whenever you put an adjective, a modifier in front of democracy, you're eroding the meaning of democracy. I don't care whether it's an Islamic democracy, a Christian democracy, or a Jewish democracy. What I'm after is a democracy without any of these modifiers, which would erode the very conception of democracy. It was for this reason that I was very critical of the Gulenists, who of course were working fist in glove with the Erdogan administration up until around 2012, 2013. The biggest difference I see between the Gulenists and the Erdoganists is the Gulenists refer sort of are more akin to traditional, or abide more by traditional, they're Islamists, but they abide more by traditional Anatolian Sufism. Whereas Erdogan and his fellow travelers are much more affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. The two broke both for financial reasons and because once the Islamists believed that they had largely defeated the more secularist groups, then Erdogan and this group, these allies of convenience, turned on one another. When I've heard from Gulenists, one thing I won't tolerate from them in my conversations is when they pretend that their current attitudes have been persistent over time. I do think that once they got into the dispute with Recep Tayyip Erdogan, once they felt the full force of Erdogan's manipulation of the state and the state security forces and the administration against them, they understood some of the errors of their ways. That you can differentiate between the attitudes of the Gulenists about democracy, about tolerance, pre-2013 and post-2013. Once they lost their grip on power, they were much more sensitive to the abuses which have occurred. With regard to the abortive coup, you know, I think some Gulenists participated in it. I also think some Kemalists participated in it, and I think some followers of the AKP participated in it. My own gut sense that I've written on this about some of the unanswered questions is I suspect at some point the MIT got wind that this coup was in the works, and rather than crush it at its inception, Erdogan decided to use it to his advantage. And he used it against, he called it a gift from God. He wanted to blame it entirely on some of his adversaries, but ultimately I think he actually had some people involved in order to keep this going so he could make this a bigger crisis and derive greater benefit from its aftermath. Within the Gulenists as well, I also think just like within the AKP, we have to be cognizant of various factions in the group. It's more of a verboten topic. I haven't seen a lot of people do a lot of good work on factions within the Gulen movement, but they certainly exist just like they've traditionally existed within the AKP.
So I'm going to move. So on the last question, we're going to turn to Erdogan's other stated enemy aside from the Gulenist movement, and that is the PKK. This week, you wrote in the National Interest that a Kurdish insurgency could potentially lead to the collapse of Turkey if Turkish policies encouraged its rivals like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, or Greece to begin supporting the PKK, which Turkey has been locked into a struggle with since the late 80s. How likely is it that you think Turkey's rivals would move in this direction if Ankara persists in these more unilateral and aggressive policy moves in places like the East Mediterranean or Libya?
Okay, well, first of all, just a caveat, Nicholas, that in Washington, of course, and you know this in the United States, there's a fine, I mean, most people understand the difference between analysis and advocacy. Too often in Turkey, people don't realize the difference or purposely are blind to the difference between analysis and advocacy. And therefore, if I'm conducting analysis that suggests that Turkey might suffer blowback from the PKK, that doesn't mean that I want Turkey to suffer blowback from the PKK or that I'm supporting the PKK. People in the United States recognize this. Some of Erdogan's inner circles purposely twist it. But what I'm basically arguing, and this is based on research, for example, when I've been in northeastern Syria, I've seen the presence between my first trip in 2014 and my last trip in 2019 to north and eastern Syria, the Qamishli area and so forth, I've seen the presence of Saudi officials there having meetings and so forth. Now, the Saudis aren't funding the PKK, but a few years ago, you wouldn't even have the Saudis meeting with them. If these countries like Egypt, like Greece, like Saudi Arabia, believe that the United States, believe that Turkey is simply being aggressive towards them and that there's no fair diplomatic way out of this, that Turkey is really seeking a fight, then Turkey shouldn't assume that other countries are going to play by its rules. They shouldn't assume that any sort of fight is going to be limited to the Aegean or to the Eastern Mediterranean. That some of these groups may believe, just like Turkey supports Hamas, why not support the PKK? Honestly, I think it's only a matter of time, the way the situation is going at this point in time, and that Turkish nationalists need to recognize that if they talk about redrawing borders, if they talk about reversing the Treaty of Lausanne and so forth, that can go both ways, and that can come back to bite Turkey, just like if Turkish foreign policy experts want to look at their support for Hamas and say Hamas is a political party, Hamas won an election, albeit just won back in 2006, they need to start looking at the electoral success of some Kurdish parties and raise the question whether the world is going to draw a fine line differentialization between the Kurds and Palestinians as Turkey would do.
Yes, and to add to your point that if they keep pushing policies like this, that their rivals might begin supporting their enemies as well. We have seen that already too, where with the sort of relationship between Russia and Syrian Kurds, where when Russia's relationship with Turkey is poor, they have increased their support to the Kurds inside of Syria. But when the relationships with Turkey were more stable, they greenlighted multiple offensives into Syria as a means to placate Turkey, often at the expense of the Kurds. So I would agree with you that it is worth considering just how some of these policies could ultimately blow back and create some strange bedfellows between Turkey's rivals and Turkey's stated enemies?
Yeah, absolutely. And all I was trying to point out in the recent article is it's always been a bright shining line, a red line, that while other countries aren't going to support the PKK inside of Turkey, I mean, ever since the end of the Cold War and so forth. Turkey might complain that the United States is supporting groups in Syria, but we've always had a fine line that we're not going to support a PKK insurgency inside of Turkey. Should any country violate that red line, all I'm pointing out is that it will be impossible to go back. Should Egypt decide that it's in their interest, if they conclude that Turkey is supporting the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, whether it's through Libya or whether it's directly, if Greece believes that Turkey is seeking, let's say Turkey seizes some islands and that Greece doesn't have the means to get them back. who's to say that Greece isn't going to violate this line? If Saudi Arabia believes that Turkey is undercutting the legitimacy of the Saudi regime, which isn't democratic, it's no less undemocratic than Turkey, unfortunately. But if Saudi Arabia concludes this, once that red line is violated, it's going to be hard to go back. And ultimately, that's going to lead to diplomatic negotiations. And the question is, if Turkey ever wants peace, can they crush the Kurds completely? They haven't shown an ability to do so. Then the alternative is, if they can't crush the Kurds completely, what are they going to be able to do? Is it going to be a diplomatic solution? And perhaps that means autonomy, perhaps that means federalism, but Turks have a right to be suspicious if we're talking federalism, whether that's just a step in the path to independence.
Excellent points. And unfortunately, we're moving towards the end of the podcast now. And I would just like to take this minute to thank Dr. Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute for joining us today. It was a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you as well.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.